Writing in the current issue of Australian Foreign Affairs, it's a splendid local publication by Black Ink Books, George Megalogenis laments the rookie PMs, how Canberra's leadership circus is damaging ties with Asia. Now you think about it. Remember the drama over Kevin Rudd disparaging the Chinese leadership as a bunch of rat effers? This was at Copenhagen in late 2009. Or Julia Gillard?
Yes, if I had a choice, I'd probably more be in a school watching kids learn to read in Australia than here in Brussels at international meetings.
Or Tony Abbott?
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin. You bet I am.
Or remember how Malcolm Turnbull did a Rudd and aggravated our largest trading partner?
Modern China was founded in 1949 with these words, Zhonghua Renmin Zanxi Lai. The Chinese people have stood up. It was an assertion of sovereignty. It was an assertion of pride. And we stand up. And so we say, Adalia Runman Zanchi Lai. The Australian people stand up.
Our rookie PMs. George Megalogenis is a journalist, political commentator and author. You may hear him regularly on the ABC's Insiders with Barry Cassidy. That's on Sunday mornings. George, welcome to Between the Lines.
How are you, Tom?
Very good indeed. Now, you argue the conduct of politics in this country shows we're getting closer and closer to looking like an unserious country. How so?
I think the problem with the revolving door of leadership, the sort of rapid turnover of prime ministers, bakes in the inevitable first mistake on the international stage and makes that the permanent impression on Australian diplomacy. The point I make, sort of by counter-reference to John Howard, when he first started out, didn't have a great first outing on his trip to Jakarta in 1996. And the sort of press on that, both international and domestic, was critical. When a leader, a newly minted leader, goes out onto the international stage, they think a little too much about the domestic audience and don't quite get the balance between domestic and international right. But John Howard was able to grow into the job, and certainly by 2002, 2003 and 2004, he was sort of looked upon as a bit of an elder statesman in the region. The point is neither Rudd nor Gillard nor Abbott nor Turnbull and perhaps now not even Morrison have had time to grow into the job. So the spinning of that leadership wheel, the roulette wheel of leadership in Australia, is creating, I think, a difficulty with our international brand.
Yeah, where's the evidence, though, that our engagement with Asia has been seriously hampered by the revolving door of Australian PMs? Because we still have a very close trade relationship throughout South and Northeast Asia, right?
Well, certainly. I mean, if this conversation was just about the economics, Australia's the best placed country on the planet in this century. We've got almost a unique relationship with the countries in Asia. We have trade surpluses, so we're exporting raw materials, and in exchange we get the best of the best through our skilled migration program and through international students. So an exchange of dirt for brains. I can't think of a country, not even Canada, not New Zealand, that is in a position like ours. But the question is, and I think it's certainly arisen with the treatment of Morrison at the G20, That was the first inkling, I think, we got internationally that people were starting to make fun of us. Remember, Angela Merkel had the cheat sheet with the biography and the picture of the guy, and she didn't care who saw him. Donald Trump asked Scott Morrison what happened to Malcolm. I think that's the point at which other countries start to look at us.
But are other countries constantly scrutinising us and reacting to events here? I think of Owen Harries, the Australian conservative intellectual, many years ago when he was in Washington. He said, quote, "In many parts of the world for extended periods of time, one needs very good peripheral vision to see Australia on the global map." How would you respond to that, George?
Well, he's spot on. So the thing is, why would we even make a name for ourselves other than just a diligent middle power, which is what we have been up until now?
But have we been disinvited from any serious regional fora?
This might become an issue for us. Risk is that people no longer treat us like they have treated us up until now. When the architecture in the Asia-Pacific has been settled, who gets to sit at that table? It's China and India especially. But who else gets to sit at that table? Indonesia? Certainly. Australia can't sit at that table as a serious country if it keeps flipping a prime minister every two or three years.
So your line then is it takes time for new prime ministers to get their feet under the desk on foreign affairs. But I can imagine, George, some of our listeners who are in the public service and the diplomatic corps would say, that's why we have a public service.
That's absolutely why we have a public service. But we don't have a culture at the moment because most of the governments run through the PMO now. We run presidential campaigns and in government, and this is one of the reasons why they get turned over so quickly. We are running personality-based governments around the prime minister. Without breaking down too many of the individual issues, just take the lines through the Indonesian relationship. Each of them, Rudd on the Oceanic Viking matter, Gillard with the live cattle trade, Abbott with the phone tapping of SBY and his wife.
If you just tuned in, you're on RN with me, Tom Switzer, and my guest is the prominent journalist George Megalogenis. He's the author of an article, The Rookie PMs, How Canberra's Leadership Circus is Damaging Ties with Asia. That's in the current issue of Australian Foreign Affairs. George, you say how, with the exception of Rudd, none of these modern PMs, you know, think of Gillard, Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison, none of them has any foreign policy experience before coming to the top job. Well, Rudd aside, who among the post-war prime ministers did have that kind of experience?
That is a good question. Fraser was a defence minister. Hawke, through his ACT connections, he was on the ILO, so he spent a lot of time overseas. Keating, as treasurer, opened the Australian economy up to the rest of the world. So engagement with the world as part of your CV was routine in those days. The other thing is you'd needed 20 years in public life before you got to the top job. You remember John Howard's old 20-year rule?
Exactly. So his point was that everyone had 20 years of experience in public life before they came to the top job, and that was obviously proven wrong by both Rudd and Gillard because they'd only been in Parliament for about 10 years, right?
But each of them had been in Parliament 10 years, and it shows. And in fact, you wonder what sort of Prime Minister either of them would have made now, 10 years later, having absorbed all the lessons of the personality clashes in their government, trying to do too much, coming in Rudd's case, which I think he had itemised 600 election promises that he wanted to implement in government, and almost impossible to get your head around.
You mentioned in this article in Australian Foreign Affairs, you mentioned how McMahon, Gorton, Fraser, these were prime ministers in the 1970s and early 80s, you know, they had these defence and external affairs cabinet positions.
Yep.
But since 72, since Whitlam beat McMahon, there's only been really one prime minister to have had a really extensive foreign affairs experience, and that is really Rudd. And you could argue he made a real mess of foreign policy. You remember the Asian NATO idea? He aggravated China, climate change. He dropped the ball at Copenhagen and the emissions trading scheme.
I think the point is he campaigned as Kevin 07. So he campaigned in his own name, won an election, and then in government thought he could run the government out of his office. Now, that's a cultural change that might have predated him. I know in the last term of the Howard government, there was a lot of work being done through the Howard office, where in the past he was probably a little more of a collaborative chairman of the board with his cabinet. The advice was, learn to share power, let your ministers run their portfolios, and the second one, which is usually tongue-in-cheek, but meant seriously, get some sleep, mate, because he was only on 3 or 4 hours a night.
Well, let's turn to John Howard's achievement in Asia as Prime Minister. You think about East Timor in 99, hard to believe 20 years ago, the East Asia Forum seat, all of that. Are we downplaying his role? I was struck by a reference, John Fain, our ABC colleague, what he said recently about John Howard.
John Howard famously said, you know, you just fly over Asia, and Paul Keating famously said, no, we have to engage. Where are we now?
Well, that is just not true. John Howard never said that, John Fain, if you're listening. It was actually
Bob Hawke. He got it back to front. Look, I was in the studio with him, and I gave him a quizzical look. But I think the thing people misunderstand about John Howard's time as Prime Minister is the ability to, A, grow into the job, and B, to fully understand what the national interest is. So if you think about Howard Mark I as opposition leader, raising questions about the pace of Asian migration and Australia's capacity to absorb it, Howard Mark II ramps up the skilled migration program, and the Asian-born population overtops the European-born population in Australia, and no one bats an eyelid. He's able to secure independence for East Timor and actually improve the relationship with Jakarta. By the time the tsunami hits, that Boxing Day tsunami of 2004, he was confident enough on the international stage to be able to offer $1 billion with no strings attached almost immediately. as assistance from Australia. So those sorts of things would have been unimaginable for the John Howard of the 80s. But then again, I would suspect he was always going to be this leader. But it didn't matter when he took the job, he was always going to be able to grow into it the way he did, because he never made the same mistake twice as a politician.
Now, finally, you lament the fact that our parliament and its representatives doesn't match the census figures you call up. Surely this takes time. I mean, you can't expect the political face of the country to keep pace with its changing demographic face, can you?
Well, certainly it'd be impossible to get the snapshot today in real time. Mm. But even if you assume there's a pipeline and there's a bit of a lag, previous waves of migration are not adequately reflected in the parliament today. I think we sort of get it back to front if we think, wouldn't it be great to be able to get ethnic diversity better reflected in the parliament? If you're just swapping one Anglo male for an Asian male or a European male, you actually haven't fixed the genuine problem of diversity and representation in the parliament, which is gender.
George, yeah. We can continue this another time. Thanks so much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you, Tom.
That was George Megalogenis. He's the author of an article, The Rookie PMs, How Canberra's Leadership Circus is Damaging Ties with Asia. That's in the current issue of Australian Foreign Affairs, and we'll post a link on our website.